South Dakota voters have about a year to get to know their candidates for governor before primary season. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, June 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we'll preview the race for governor with our Dakota political junkies. We'll talk about the rise to the state's highest elected post by Governor Larry Roden and how he sits with the electorate should he decide he wants to keep that job. Seth Tupper and Jonathan Ellis offer analysis into his political future. Plus, later in the hour, we hear from the first candidate to announce his intentions. John Hansen is with us for a look at his economic development priorities as he runs for governor. But first, Mike Thompson returns for a look at the U.S. Supreme Court and a case that blocked the nation's first publicly funded faith-based charter school. We'll unpack that case after the news. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, and that news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In late May, the U.S. Supreme Court deadlocked on a First Amendment case. The 4-4 tie vote meant that Oklahoma's ruling on a Catholic charter school would stand. In other words, what would have been the country's first religious public charter school has to remain, for now, private. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He sat down with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio here in Sioux Falls.
This was Oklahoma Charities versus Oklahoma Statewide Charter School versus Oklahoma. The charter school wanted public money from Oklahoma. It's a Catholic charter school. They wanted public money to fund the charter school. Oklahoma court said that you couldn't have any money. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court granted certiorari on that one. And they couldn't come to an agreement because it was 4 to each side.
So how does it become 4 to each side? Somebody's not there.
Yeah, Amy Coney Barrett, she didn't take part in the case for some reason.
She recused herself. We don't know why?
No, we don't know why. They don't have to tell us why.
Okay. It's not because she's Catholic. Because she would hear other cases. And there's more than one Catholic on
sure.
the... Yeah. So it's not that.
No.
It's, you know, she has a relationship or some background with somebody involved in the case. Most likely. I'm speculating. I don't know.
Right.
But it would not be solely based on her own faith, most likely.
Most likely not, right.
Okay.
Right, most likely not. But, we'll never know why she recused herself.
So what happens in a tie?
Then the lower court decision is affirmed, meaning that the charter school doesn't get any money.
The judgment is affirmed by an equally divided court.
By an equally divided court. And that's all they said. That's all they said. Yeah, we don't know which justice was on which side of the issue. When we talked,
that's all they have to say. Don't they have to issue an opinion?
No, they don't have to issue an opinion. It's the U.S. Supreme Court. They essentially do what they want. I mean, generally.
Let's go back because we've talked about this case before, and it's a very interesting one. And this is by no means the end of the discussion.
No. Okay. So this one is about the First Amendment free exercise clause, and this is the one where, when the Supreme Court issued the writ of certiorari, it defined the issues, and the way the court defined the issues in this one really pointed to, I thought, that there's going to be a ruling in favor of the charter school.
Okay.
Because the question was so pointed that I thought that's the way it would go. I didn't think we were going to end up 4-4, which is, I don't have any statistics on this, but it's a rarity, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember hearing in my recent memory.
Yeah.
So what does it mean for the future? Because it's not saying that there cannot be religious charter schools ever and forever.
Right.
It means in Oklahoma, this Catholic school will not get its funding.
Right. That's what it means. It would depend on what maybe other circuit courts do.
Okay.
There could be a circuit who decides the same issue differently, that could bring it up again, because if you have circuits that are in conflict on the exact issue, mm-hmm. then the Supreme Court will likely settle that dispute.
Right. And in that case, we might have a full court.
We might
deciding
have a full
we
court.
Might see the full opinions and we might get more information.
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting.
No, it is. It is. It's very interesting.
So as I'm interpreting this is a very interesting and religion and protection for religion has been very successful with this particular Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
And if you are for the separation of church and state, there's been some erosion. So it would depend on, you know, what direction you come at this argument with. But basically, we're trying to say the government cannot make, you know, cannot force students to be indoctrinated into a religion, but the government can also not discriminate against the religion and withhold government funds from them while they provide them to everyone else. And that's the tension that's at stake here.
Yeah, very good. Very good way to put it. Right, exactly. That is the tension, where the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, they frequently come into contact. The government doesn't want to establish a religion by giving a religious school some benefit. On the other hand, like you said, if we provide it for some, we have to provide it for all. If we, being the government, provide it for some, we have to provide it for all. And that was the argument here. They're given, the government's given money to other religious organizations. Why not us?
That's Mike Thompson. He's an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls in the city of Sioux Falls. The nationwide outbreak of measles officially hit South Dakota last week. A man in Meade County was confirmed to have the virus. SDPB's C.J. Keene reported on that case and has spoken with a Monument Health doctor about measles. He joined me from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
It's definitely made it to South Dakota. We took some time getting there, considering we're in a reasonably large measles outbreak across the country, but multiple cases here in the Black Hills, sure to spread across South Dakota. And right now, it's not looking great for some counties in the state, which are reporting as low as 56% measles or MMR vaccine, excuse me, vaccination rates. So it's looking like we're not even close to the worst of it yet.
All right. So tell me a little bit about who you have been talking to as you continue to cover the story.
So as I've followed this measles story, one of the most interesting conversations I had was with a pediatrician here with a West River Monument Health branch, Dr. Paula Marsland. She had very interesting statistics about who measles is most affecting, primarily 19 and under. About two-thirds of the cases across America are in 19 and under children. And along with that, measles is approximately three times more contagious than flu, COVID, or Ebola. So this is not something to really be trifled with.
So let's talk about the highly contagious nature of this disease. Tell me what officials are doing to let people know if they might have been exposed.
So we're seeing releases, not daily, but every time we get a new case, we're seeing a release that says, hey, this is where this outbreak has taken place, and this is what you need to do. And symptoms don't begin right away, and it's a two-stage process. The first one is a fever, a cough, or a runny nose. Following that, you get the high fever, the more severe fever, and the blotchy red rash that measles is famous for. Along with that, these droplets linger in the air. So let's take, for example, an elevator. If somebody were in an elevator and, you know, coughed or sneezed or anything, a person who had been exposed to measles, that is going to stay in the elevator for some time. According to my conversations with doctors, 9 out of 10 vulnerable people in the next 2 hours in that elevator would be exposed to measles. So this is not something to be trifled with, especially if you know that you might be carrying a case.
Basically, two MMR shots, lifetime immunity. So many of us do not have to worry about that. But as we look at the numbers on the Department of Health's dashboard, to your point, there are counties with really low rates of MMR vaccinations, so something to watch in the state, correct?
Absolutely. And it's very important to remember, two MMR shots, and you are considered effectively immune, and you can get those at any time. You do not have to be a newborn to get your MMR shots, and it's highly encouraged that you consult your own primary care doctor to ask if you know you are unvaccinated. And there's also tests to find out if you are still up on your immunity schedule.
CJ Keene, access to vaccinations can be a challenge for some people. Do we see any efforts from public health officials to address that problem?
At least here in the Black Hills, we do see some, because the measles vaccinations are coming to Rapid City at the very least. The Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board is bringing a clinic to Lakota Homes, specifically for children 1 to 18 who haven't yet been vaccinated. That'll be coming up June 12th and 13th. And that, again, is brought to you by the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Healthcare Board at the Lakota Homes here in Rapid City.
That's SDPB's CJ Keene. Find more of his reporting online at sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Our Dakota political junkies join us today with a news roundup from across the state. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. He joins us from SDPB's Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. And Jonathan Ellis is co-founder of the Dakota Scout. He is with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
At South Dakota Searchlight, we're part of a national nonprofit called States Newsroom. And States Newsroom has 39 state outlets, including South Dakota Searchlight. And we get together, the editors get together every year with our D.C. Bureau folks that we have and our HQ staff. And so there's about 50 people. And usually they've met in D.C. They decided this year to have it more like in a regional airport hub that would be more centrally located for everybody to fly to. And they chose Minneapolis. And since we're a state-focused nonprofit, state news, they decided to see if we could get the top state officials from Minnesota to come and do a live Q&A with us as journalists. And so we got Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota and the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, and they sat in for a live Q&A in front of us. And then the state's news outlet in Minnesota, the Minnesota Reformer, did some stories on those appearances.
So how much was unpack the election and how much was, what's happening now in Minnesota?
The Walz appearance was almost totally unpacking the election, and you and everybody else has probably seen he's been on something of a tour lately. I think he was in South Carolina, and he's clearly signaling and thinking about running for president next time. That was an interesting appearance because, I'd never had, met Tim Walz or covered him personally or anything, just, seen him on TV, whatever, like everybody else. And in person, he's just, I guess I would describe it as just him being in a really awkward place right now where he, is so clearly interested in running for president again, yet so clearly also carries the baggage of being on the losing ticket from last time.
Sure.
It's just, you almost feel the unease when you're in the room with him of him trying to balance these two things, and not quite really knowing how to try to explain away the last election and put that behind him and not fully being able to do that, not really being able to then move forward. And so that was, that was kind of, it was just a sort of an uneasy thing to be in his presence. You could kind of feel the difficult position he's in because of that.
Yeah. Do you think that's because of what people have said to him, or do you think that's because he's trying to figure out how to position himself for a future run? Like, does he go around and everybody's like, "Hey, you screwed this up. You let us down. You failed at this. If it weren't for you."
Well, I think it's just because they lost, and he it was a. He had to make a calculated decision whether to accept the invitation to be on the ticket or not.
Mm-hmm.
He accepted it. They lost, and he might not be able to come back from that nationally. You think back to sure. Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. Where's Tim Kaine these days on the national scene? I don't know if he wants to be on the national scene anymore, but certainly he's
doing Saturday Night Live appearances about nobody knowing
is
who he is. Yeah. That was the bit. My name is Tim Kaine. I ran for vice president. Everybody's like, "Who is this man?" No idea. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So he's having fun with his image, I guess.
And so Tim Walz is, Governor Walz is really trying to keep that from happening. But, the pull of down on him of being on a losing ticket, I think, is going to be very, very hard to fight against.
What does he say went wrong?
Where
did he
really
fail? Because he says, "Hey, we did not deliver." He's, "I want to own this. I want to own the fact that we made mistakes." What does he say those mistakes were?
Well, he doesn't seem to really have a coherent speech figured out for that yet. He did talk a lot about, communication failures. He has been kind of trotting this narrative out there that maybe he was too tightly controlled and everything during the campaign. But you sit there listening to that and you think, you were the vice presidential candidate. You weren't the presidential candidate. So of course you were controlled to some extent. You should be. My main takeaway from it was really there just wasn't, if people are looking for, him having identified this one thing that can totally explain, why they lost and why he could be more successful in the future. No, he doesn't seem to have that figured out yet.
Jonathan Ellis, anything about the, as we watch people unpack an election after it's over, that's useful? In general, are there things that you think are useful in election postmortems?
Seth alluded to one part of this was he had to make the calculated risk of whether to be accept the VP slot. And really, I think that he tied himself to that anchor because, I mean, I this is my opinion, and I'm going to maybe piss some people off here, but Kamala Harris was a terrible candidate, and he kind of he tied himself to that. And so he's got to get beyond what was a very poorly run campaign, which he probably really had very little making to, you know, wasn't his campaign necessarily, but he's associated with it.
Why was she a terrible candidate?
Give
me two reasons why you think Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, was a terrible candidate.
Yeah, she had very poor communication skills. I don't think she could, Seth Wright talked about how Walz is working on this speech. Her speeches were terrible. She just could not communicate. I think that the campaign aired very early when it associated itself with a lot of celebrities that turned on and elites that regular people kind of are, you know, don't find, they can't relate to those people. So that was a very early era. If you remember this, the campaign, they brought in, you know, movie star singers and TV, you know, Oprah was, and regular people don't relate to that. So that was a big campaign from right out at the gate, in my opinion.
Donald Trump is not known as a smooth communicator.
True.
So saying she's a terrible communicator in a campaign against someone who has communications, Jamie's not what we would traditionally consider an effective communicator. Obviously, he communicates his message and he holds the spotlight very well. But I guess that's what I'm wondering. Like, why is she a bad communicator when her opponent communicates in the way that he does?
I think that he ran a more disciplined campaign in the sense that he did stick to the issues that won the day, immigration, things of that nature. And in that sense, of course, you can pick apart his speeches and say he says these stupid, outlandish things.
I didn't say that.
He does at times.
To be clear, so, I did not say he was stupid.
He does.
Yeah.
But we could go back and dissect some of her speeches, and it's just sometimes it goes into, she just was a poor communicator.
So let's talk about candidates for governor now here in South Dakota, because we're seeing early announcements and communication strategies, which will continue to follow these candidates. Jonathan Ellis, you want to start with John Hansen, Speaker Hansen, and how he came out of the gate making his announcement and what we're seeing early on from him.
He's been a known kind of quantity in the, you know, conservative, social conservative universe for quite a while now. I think he's probably in his 10th year in the legislature. Been very prominent on abortion issues for a long time. The pipeline stuff, very early against pipeline, or at least eminent domain. And so he has a lot of street cred in that community, and he came out very early. And at his announcement at the Military Heritage Alliance here in Sioux Falls, it was very, very well attended. And a lot of the rank-and-file conservative activists were there. Now you've got Toby Doden getting into the race, and he's sort of, you know, drinking from the same reservoir there. A lot of people who are in politics will know who Toby Doden is just because he's wealthy and he's financed some campaigns. But he doesn't have the broader name recognition maybe that John Hansen does. And so Toby, you've seen now, as he announced, he has since now he's been on TV. He's got to try to win people over with his message, people who don't know who he is. And so that's why you've seen it's very early for TV ads for governor. But that's kind of the reality that he's got to face. He's got to introduce himself to voters who don't know who he is.
Yeah. Seth, do people know who John Hansen is? West River?
I
mean, political people
no.
do. People who are, you know, people who are fundraising, the political class, if you will, know who John Hansen is. But that's been my question, Mark. Doesn't he also have a challenge with name recognition going into this?
Sure. And of course, you know, this is difficult to gauge. And I think as journalists, I'm always trying to keep myself aware of this and my reporters. And we are talking about a Republican primary here. So obviously,
right.
You know, I mean, these are engaged. People are going to vote in that are engaged in Republican politics and stuff. But there will also be quite a few who aren't. This is going to be, you know, an election year that's going to have a lot of big races, so bring a lot of people out. So I think that we as journalists, you know, people who are embedded in this every day, we do tend, I do too, we tend to overestimate how much people are known outside of the bubble that we operate in as journalists and people who are inside of this all the time. So, you know, I certainly don't think John Hansen or Toby Doden have, you know, name recognition with the general populace, with the general electorate, even maybe with a lot of Republicans.
Yeah. I'm not sure Governor Roden does. After I interviewed Governor Roden, I was telling people I interviewed the guy, and they didn't know his name. And they asked me again and again, who is he? Who is he? Who is he? And I was really surprised by that at the time. I was like, how do you not know who Larry Roden is? But to your point, Seth, a lot of people are not living the lives that the three of us are living.
Right.
Where we're,
how many
you know,
people still think Kristi Noem is the governor of South Dakota? You might be shocked
by
that.
She's not going to be on the ballot, everybody. You know, so there's going to be someone else.
But I'll tell you, you bring up Roden, and the one great advantage that he has, obviously, with Noem leaving and him being installed, you know, from lieutenant governor to governor, is if you see what he's been doing ever since he took office, he's been traveling the state, you know, on the state's dime, as he's allowed to do as governor, you know, doing official business, of course, but also it's partially campaigning. And he's been to towns all across the state, great and small. He's met hundreds, thousands of people probably since he took office. Mm-hmm. And so he's been basically campaigning from day one and you know, building that name recognition slowly and quietly, but doing it. Yeah. And as Jonathan mentioned, you know, how does Toby Doden do that? Well, he's going to have to spend a lot of money to do that. And if you're going to spend
a
lot
bus,
of money,
right? He's got a big basically a lot of money. Yeah.
And if you're going to spend a lot of money this early, you know, a year out from the primary.
Sure.
Wow. I hope you have a lot of money.
So, Ellis, what's the strategy here? Because, I mean, some of big names who people have predicted will enter this race have not yet entered the race. Cue Representative Dusty Johnson, who everybody says he's going to enter, but we don't know when, we don't know if. So do you get out there? Or, I mean, is that part of the strategy? Get out there early, get out there really fast, build up name recognition, you know, establish yourself before he ever comes and announces, or he might not.
Well, I don't know that Dusty Johnson needs to worry about. I mean, he's
no, I'm talking about the other people. Yeah, I don't think Dusty Johnson needs to worry about it.
I mean, Toby Doden, I think,
Does Toby Doden need to worry about when Dusty Johnson enters the race? Does John Hansen have to worry about that?
No, I think they have to worry about each other.
Okay.
Because they know that there will be a Dusty Johnson-esque, if not Dusty Johnson himself, Dusty Johnson-esque candidate that they'll have to face. I mean, this is a fight for a much more, and people don't know who Larry Roden is. Your Republican primary voters do.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more engaged. And this is the universe you're worrying about. You're not worrying about the people who don't know who Larry Roden is. And that, you know, that's a different world. That's a general election world, if they vote at all, for that matter. So this is where where Seth says, the voters out West River probably don't know who he is, but the ones who are politically active know who John Hansen is, and some of them will know who Toby Doden is just because he's been financing campaigns through his political action committee.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, he needs to get out early. Dusty Johnson, I mean, you know, no.
Why do they run against Roden at all?
Why are they running against Roden?
Right. There's not a ton of daylight between all of these candidates, policy-wise. There are a lot of, I guess, in the Venn diagram, there's lots of places that they're similar. Why challenge the incumbent who's popular, has the advantage of being the incumbent? Why spend a bunch of money to try to, I mean, if you would be happy with how the state is being run in a lot of ways. Why do people throw their hat in the ring at this point?
Well, I think there are people who think it could be run more conservatively. If you ask the John Hansen and Toby Doden world.
We'll have John Hansen on later in the show. We did ask him.
Historically.
We will invite we have not invited Toby Doden yet, but he'll be next. We like to give the announcement and then a little bit of time and then the invitation. So
historically, a lieutenant governor who took over from a governor in office have not been, you know, strong candidates necessarily. Hmm. I mean, they haven't gone on to win their nomination.
Yeah.
And in some cases, their nomination, and certainly in general, you know, I think probably in at least the two most recent cases that I can think of, Seth, maybe I'm not to put him on the spot, but I don't even think they won their party nominations. Hmm. So
lots of challenges ahead, Seth.
Well, and I would add to that, I think to answer your question, Lori, is that people are viewing this as an open seat. You know, Kristi Noem resigned, and the lieutenant governor came in, and you could call him an incumbent, you know, sort of, not really, but kind of. And I think people viewed this from the beginning as an open seat. And I think myself, a lot of people underestimated Governor Roden's ability to campaign for the seat. I think a lot of us, as Jonathan maybe alluded to, were reflecting back to when Walter Dale Miller took over as governor after the death of Governor Mickelson. And, you know, Bill Janklow came in and said, you know, thanks, Walter Dale, but, you know, I'll take it from here. Right. And just sort of pushed him aside. And I think a lot of people were thinking that was Roden's fate. And he showed that, you know, maybe he's going to be a little bit stronger than that. And so that has maybe made it more difficult for people who thought they were going to have an easier path. But I don't think it caused anybody to say, oh, I'm not going to run now, because open seats don't come along very often, obviously.
And I think that's the answer. That's an insightful answer. They view it as an open seat, and those just don't come along very often. Now's your chance.
So if you're going to take your shot,
take
it now.
Yeah, interesting. But I agree with you, Seth, that Larry Roden has come out very strong. So anybody who was underestimating him probably is regretting underestimating him as a candidate, I would say.
Yeah, and I think
he's a strong candidate for governor,
Immediately, you know, during the session when he chose Tony Van Huysen to be his lieutenant governor, and people thought, oh, whoa, that's, you know, if Tony Van Huysen is signing on with Larry Roden,
right?
And people thought maybe he would be aligned more with Dusty Johnson or somebody like that, you know, bringing back some old Dewey-Yard administration officials to serve in his cabinet, having a very organized, aggressive schedule getting out in the state. Yeah, I think he was, from the get-go, he if you were paying attention, he put people on notice that, you know, he's probably going to run, and he's probably going to run hard.
I would say the one unknown on all of this is because of the state's campaign finance reporting requirements, we are not going to know how strong he is in that department, and that's a very critical department.
Fundraising.
Whether you like it or not, you need money, and you need a lot of money. And so we will have to wait and see. That's you know, it is. I am impressed with how he has gotten out and under the guise of economic opportunity and toured the state. And I think he has been strong in that department. Where we don't know, that again, the unknown is that translating to campaign donations?
Yeah. I've noticed how often he comes out and distinguishes himself from Kristi Noem, but yet never distances himself from Kristi Noem. Again and again, he credits her for what she did. He connects his name to hers. He is and forever will be her partner in politics. But then he'll make a sort of a wry comment like, well, maybe we communicate a little bit better, or if not better, a little bit differently, chuckle, chuckle, and makes it, I'm not her. But yet, politically, we are very much aligned. And I think that's smart politicking as well.
Plus, he'll drink a beer, whereas Kristi Noem wouldn't have.
Okay. You know, not something I knew. Nor do I care if either one of them drinks a beer.
One of the regular guys who will sit down and have a beer.
We'll leave it there with the regular guys. I'll step off. Seth Tupper, Jonathan Ellis, thanks so much.
I'm going to go get a beer. Thanks.
That's Seth Tupper of South Dakota Searchlight and Jonathan Ellis of the Dakota Scout. You can find this conversation and all of our Dakota Political Junkies interviews on your favorite podcasting platform. Just search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The race for governor of South Dakota has officially begun. South Dakota Speaker of the House, John Hansen, is in the running. He stopped by SDPB's Sioux Falls studios for a conversation about his platform. How did it begin that you wanted to make this run at this time?
Well, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of different conversations with a lot of different people. And of course, you know, it starts with, you know, really like I do everything, asking God what God's calling me to do. And then discerning that and pursuing that. So that's always the first step for me. And then, of course, conversations with Sheila, my wife. You know, we've got 6 kids at home. Our oldest is 13. Our youngest is a year and a half. And so anything that I do, they got to be on board too, you know, or it's a mission together, our family. So everything's got to have buy-in from the family, of course. And then, of course, talking to a lot of people and getting a lot of encouragement from people from across the state who think that we can do better in our executive branch. And they look to me and they look to my experience in the legislature, my experience as Speaker of the House, my role in a lot of these major issues that we've seen come up before the people of this state, and my willingness to stand on the front lines of those fights and really push for the conservative agenda. A lot of those things just came together, and it seemed like this is the right time, this is the right moment, the right opportunity to step up and take on the opportunity to serve the people as governor.
All right. A little bit about your background. Kid from Del Rapids?
That's right. I was born in Yankton.
Okay.
And moved to Del Rapids when I was just a kid. So I did all my growing up in Del Rapids. Met Sheila. She was my high school girlfriend. Ended up marrying her. And we have, like I said earlier, 6 kids. And we love Del Rapids. We love small town Del Rapids. Del Rapids is just over 4,000, just under 4,000. It's probably over 4,000 now. Mm-hmm. But we love small town community and sort of just the South Dakota small town way of life.
Yeah.
You know? And so we've been raising our family in Del Rapids, and we wouldn't have it any other way.
And you spent some time milking cows, which was unusual. Tell us that story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when Sheila and I were dating in high school, she was growing up on the farm. She was a farm girl, and I was a town kid. And so I knew if there was one place that she would always be at where I'd go hang out with her after school, it was the family milking barn. And so I spent a lot of time hanging out with Sheila, milking cows at the family milking barn. So I like to say, I think I hold the unofficial South Dakota record for the most dairy cows milked by a town kid in South Dakota history. I've heard that's in dispute, but I think I hold it.
There's a comp. Can you still milk a cow?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
What's hard about it?
It's actually not that difficult.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
No, it just takes time.
I've never milked a cow, so my confession there is now. You talk about, you know, some of the issues that you've been successful with, Amendment G, mm-hmm. Carbon capture pipeline, sort of motivating people to speak out against that. When we think about ballot initiatives in South Dakota, we often think of the social issues and where the Democrats might be successful on the ballot. These were successful issues on the ballot for perhaps a different area of the political spectrum. But often in South Dakota, the executive is right in the middle, is a in-the-middle Republican, and some of those side issues, social issues, end up being fought out in our ballot process. When you're successful with one, how does that translate to actually getting to the governor's office? Because now you have to convince everybody in South Dakota that you're the leader that they need.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've shown throughout my entire time in the legislature, you know, I've been serving now in the state legislature for, I just did my 10th session. And so obviously when you're in there for that long, you take on a whole host of issues. And it's not just the social issues, it's the nuts and bolts, you know. And I've also served on a lot of interim committees like the Rules Review Committee. Rules Review Committee takes on all of the administrative rules that come into the state. And anytime those get proposed by the administration, we have to look at those to make sure that they're within the authority that's been delegated to them by the legislature. And so, you know, you kind of hear about the big issues in the news, like Amendment G, which we fought and defeated, like the eminent domain issue, private property rights, which we, you know, passed a bill this last legislative session to make sure that these companies can't just come in and use eminent domain to take your land without your consent, which I think is very important. So those issues tend to get a lot of attention, but there's a ton of issues that are happening all the time that are just sort of the nuts and bolts of the government, how things function, the essential services, and I've got a ton of experience handling those issues as well.
Also, Lieutenant Governor candidate and yourself, southeast corner of the state. You got to reach the whole state. You got to head up to Sisseton.
Yeah,
you got to head to
that's right.
To Lemon and everywhere in between and get that name recognition. Which some of the polls early on, which are not really worth paying a whole lot of attention to, but mm-hmm. not everybody knows who you are.
Sure.
How are you going to get out in the state and get people? What's your plan for the summer?
Yeah, well, the summer is already jam-packed, and it's only going to get fuller. And we've been out there. You know, it's a rapid city. We went out to Bennington County for their Lincoln Day dinner. We were out there for a launch event. We did a launch event out there just not this weekend, but the weekend before. We were in Lawrence County for their Lincoln Day dinner and had another reception. And I tell you, the meetings that we've had with ranchers in the area and some other folks out there have really been overwhelmingly positive. I think people are excited for this vision that we have for the state, putting people first again, putting, you know, faith and family and freedom really at the foresight the forefront of our focus as a state government. So the more that we get out there, the reception has just been tremendous. And so we're just going to keep going all over the state and spreading the good word and meeting more folks. And I think it's going to be great.
Faith, family, freedom, strength, family first, family values. These are all things that I think a lot of candidates on the Republican side ahead of the primary are going to lead with. How do you distinguish yourself in what really could arguably be a very crowded field?
Well, I think when you're looking for somebody who stands for those issues, what I want is a proven fighter. I want somebody who I can point to and look at and think, you know what? Yeah, they don't just talk the talk, but they've been walking the walk over all of these years. And that's something that I've been doing. And I know that's something that Carla Lems, my lieutenant governor candidate, has been doing as well. And so when you look at faith and family and freedom and those issues that I think are important to all of us, and you go back to the fight for life with Amendment G, I was at the forefront of that. We started an organization called the Life Defense Fund, and Life Defense Fund led the effort to defeat that constitutional amendment that the overwhelming majority of South Dakota agreed is wrong for our South Dakota Constitution. When you look at the property rights fight in the state, and constitutional private property rights were under threat, and hundreds of people in the state were getting sued for their land to be condemned by an out-of-state, for-profit, foreign-backed company, I was at the front lines of that fight, defending people. Then you look at all the, you know, all the other issues, those bigger ones that have come up in this state. We have really been leading the way to make sure that our South Dakota way of life is protected and preserved. And so that's what is really going to differentiate us from anybody else, I think, who is going to get into this race. We are tested. We are proven. We are battle tested. We have been in the trenches on these fights. And when your back is up against the wall, you want somebody who you know is going to stand up for you. That's me, and that's Carla Lems, and I think that's what we bring to the table.
Let's talk a little bit about the South Dakota economy, economic growth, economic development, but also, as you have said, free market should be running this and not incentives and tax breaks for corporations. Help us understand exactly what you mean and how you would do things different than, say, the Christie Noem or the Larry Roden administration.
Well, I am a classic free market Republican. I believe in low taxation and low regulation and letting small, medium-sized businesses and South Dakota entrepreneurs really go out and create amazing businesses, which we've seen throughout the decades in this state. The tremendous businesses that have been built by South Dakota entrepreneurs are really astounding. And there's some that are trying to get away from that. And what we see is instead of trusting the free market and our entrepreneurs, the state is getting involved and putting sort of the heavy thumb of government on this project or that project, taking taxpayer money from these businesses and giving it over to that business. Instead, this is a sort of redistribution scheme that we've seen play out over the years. And so, you know, a couple of examples that come to mind. One, for instance, there was a company up in the Madison area that was going to set up a shrimping operation called True Shrimp. And they were going to build this shrimp farm, so to speak, in Madison. And so the state goes and gives them millions of dollars in incentives to build their building and their business in South Dakota. Well, guess what? It never happened. And so the taxpayers are just out millions of dollars for a business that never even came to South Dakota. So that's money that was taxed from some of our businesses, so our people, given to this company, and they never even came and did anything in South Dakota. It's never a benefit to any of us.
So would you recommend more oversight, or would you recommend not having those incentives or tax incentives? Like, what does it look like in practical? Because a lot of the businesses in South Dakota who have been incredibly successful have come to South Dakota and chosen us instead of Minnesota, instead of North Dakota, because we have made it attractive, because we've been open for business or open for opportunity. Does that end under your administration or just reform?
Well, I think what's been most attractive to people across the country, and we've seen it especially since COVID, is just our reputation for freedom. That's what's attractive to people. And you look at all the people who've moved to South Dakota to bring their family or their business over, especially these last 5 years. It's not because some big crony corporate payout from the government. It's because we have low regulation, low tax environment, and we have a reputation for freedom in this state. So those are the things that I want to focus on. I don't think it's appropriate that the government hand out millions and millions of dollars in corporate welfare payments to businesses who don't need it. And so I wouldn't do that.
To the governor's Department of Economic Development, does that budget shrink? Does the department go away? You said in your announcement that, you know, day one, South Dakota Doge, and people cheered. What is that? What does that mean to you? Where exactly does South Dakota Doge? Where do you start looking for those places to cut in the economic development world?
Well, definitely at the governor's Office of Economic Development. And so, you know, you got to look in terms of what is that doing that's actually a good function of state government. And if there's things that they're doing that are effective, then maybe you keep those. But all of this corporate welfare spending and kickbacks to political donors that we've seen over the years, those have got to end. And I'm committing to ending those things.
Do you come in with a blanket percentage cut? Do you hire someone, bring someone with you to look at those things? Do you already know what they are as Speaker of the House and as with your experience as a state legislature?
Well, there's a mix. You know, this last legislative session, for instance, we looked at eliminating the Future Fund. And the Future Fund is a massive fund. I can't remember exactly what the number is off the top of my head, but maybe it was $70 million or something like that, that the state is taking from all of the small and medium-sized businesses in the state, taking their money from them and redistributing to other businesses. Some businesses, by the way, who end up competing with them. So it's not like it's, you know, inviting just new businesses who aren't doing anything in the state in terms of that particular sector or this particular business model. It might be your own competition that the state is incentivizing to come compete with you. I don't think that's fair to our South Dakota businesses. So those sorts of things, that's one particular example. But I also think, generally speaking, when you talk about South Dakota Doge, the state government has just gotten too big over the years. And I think back to my first year in the legislature, which was 2011, and the state had a $127 million budget deficit. And at the time, that represented basically 10% of the state.
Deficit?
Yeah, we had a deficit. Yeah, $127 million budget deficit in 2011. Yeah.
And but we have to balance our budget every year.
Right. But
so help me understand what you mean there.
Well, at the time, we were using one-time money to pay for ongoing expenses. And to me and a lot of other people, that's not truly a balanced budget. Now, since then, you might remember we passed a constitutional amendment to make sure that we structurally balanced the budget. It wasn't the case back then. And so my first year in office, we did have a $127 million budget deficit. And I campaigned at the time to say, I'm going to go in there and I will not vote to raise your taxes. We're going to cut the government in order to solve that budget deficit. And that's what we did at the time. So now you fast forward, the government is even bigger. It's more bloated. And I think it's time once again to look across the board to say, what are we spending all this money on? And really, we need to trim back because people are getting taxed too much, particularly at the property tax level. And I think the most appropriate way to reduce those property tax burdens on people is to really look at the size of government, trim it down, and then allow those savings to go down to the people so they can pay less in taxes and spend their own money the way they want to spend it.
Do you have a sense of departments that need to be cut across the board, services that need to be reduced? Because we're a pretty low tax, low service state as it is. And people always say, where else is there left to cut? It's been a really tough, plus we're seeing, you know, reduction in what's coming from the federal government. So there isn't a lot of extra money. There's not a lot of fat. You're seeing fat where?
Well, I mean, you look at a lot of what we just talked about, some of this crony capitalism spending, that's a lot of fat that I think needs to be trimmed. I'll give you one other example of that. You know, we have a building in Sioux Falls. There's one in Rapid City. It's called South Dakota One Stop. That's an office building that the state leases out now from a private developer. And that office building, because of the way that the administration did it, is costing the state of South Dakota, the taxpayers of this state, $300 million over a 30-year lease that they've locked us into. $300 million over a 30-year lease. Now, when that lease term expires, we own nothing. All we have is the ability to go beg for a lease renewal. Now compare that to, well, just down the street from here is the Citibank building. The Citibank building could have been bought for $33, $34 million. The state could have owned it. It's actually more square footage than the One Stop building. And we would have saved hundreds of millions of dollars. But we didn't do that. Why didn't we do that? I don't know. But that's a bad deal for taxpayers. And so that's a great example of that's hundreds of millions of dollars in wasteful spending that we could just avoid if we're making better decisions.
So what's your commitment then? Because legislators didn't have an idea of what exactly was happening with that Sioux Falls One Stop, for example, and complained about what they knew and what they didn't know. If I remember this correctly, you would remember it more than I would because you were right in the thick of it. What's your commitment then day one as Governor Hansen to say, I'm going to make sure that the state legislature is part of the decision-making process?
Well, that's a good question. For many reasons. But one of the things that we've seen as a legislative branch is really the administration's unwillingness to fully open up the books. And you talk to some of our appropriators and they'll share that with you. When you start to drill down, you know, below, you know, to sort of like lower tier spending, not just like big broad categorical spending on agencies and stuff like that, but when you really try to drill down as to what agencies are spending their money on, it's really difficult to get that information, even as a legislative branch. And so one of the things that I want to do as a governor, having served in the administration, is to help restore that balance of power, empower the legislature with more information in terms of what the budget actually is, what the administration is actually spending money on, because the more people, the more transparency when it comes to how our budget process works and how our spending is, I think the more we'll have better decisions made in terms of how we actually spend that money.
I want to circle back for our remaining time to economic growth. How do we measure, like, what are you, you're for a free market. Do you have data that you're going to measure and say this is working? If you become governor and things shrink a little bit and businesses aren't coming here and people get a little nervous, does that even out over time? Or are you less concerned about growth than other things? Do you think your growth plan is going to be bigger and build a bigger, more economically robust South Dakota? Help us understand how you look at performance goals and measurement beyond the philosophy of, hey, this is what should happen, to what are the results and outcomes going to be of this plan if we commit to it and move forward?
Well, I think if we are willing to boldly move forward with a conservative, pro-freedom agenda in this state, where we have low taxes and low regulation, businesses will flock to this state. You know, it's already attractive now because we don't have an income tax. Imagine if we had a significantly more reduced property tax system. How many more people would want to come to this state, have their family live here, do business in this state because we champion freedom, low taxes, and low regulation. So that is the way. That is the success story that we've seen in America. I mean, if you look at the American economy and you look at the whole scope of even human civilization, you look at Western civilization, you think, what has been the biggest driver of economic growth? It is, without a doubt, the free market. And so we just need to get back to trusting that. And if we trust the free market, we trust entrepreneurs, we trust people to make the best decisions with their money, then the economy will just flourish and South Dakota will absolutely thrive with great businesses and great jobs.
John Hansen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's John Hansen, currently South Dakota's Speaker of the House. He is running for South Dakota governor in 2026. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.